Hi, everyone. Welcome. One quick thing before we get underway with today's podcast. Sorry to do this, but we ended up running way longer than expected. We were certainly prepared for this to be a thorough interview. It ended up taking pretty close to all day. I don't know the exact runtime at this point, but I suspect it will be much closer to 7 hours than six. So I think the move here is to release this in chunks. I'm at this hour planning on releasing this in three parts, and today is going to be part one. Parts two and three are not far behind. The plan, as things stand right now, you know, barring catastrophe, is for part two to go up on Sunday and part three to go up on Tuesday. So certainly not too far off in the distance there, but should probably go without saying, given the runtime, that we get into a lot of different things with Ian here today. And I think most of you, hopefully at least, will find it worth it. I don't know how many of you will make it through the entire 6 hours or whatever, but there is more, at least as far as I'm concerned, in this podcast from the perspective of someone who has played in multiple different kind of generations of the show, different eras of the franchise, than I have ever really heard gotten into before. Ian was a totally open book, and I am really happy with how all of this turned out. So parts two and three coming very soon. Here now is part one. Enjoy. All right, welcome back, everybody. Here we are once again talking a little more Big Brother 22. Dom, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. It feels a little tenuous to say we're back once again talking about Big Brother because we haven't spoken about it in quite a while now. The season did not quite live up to our expectations. Part of the reason for that is Ian did not go as far maybe as we all would have liked him to, but it is great to be back here with him talking about the season. We knew back in 2012 when we spoke to Ian about BB14 that it was very likely that he would come back again and that we would be back here with him talking about it. The only question was, how long was that going to take? Turns out it took the better part of 8 years for that all to come together. So good to be catching up with Ian and good to be kind of in that mentality for the first time in quite a while.
Yes, absolutely. So let's not just keep mentioning him like he's not here. Let's welcome in your winner of Big Brother 14, Ian Terry. Welcome back. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for having me on here. Really excited to speak with you guys. I think that I've always liked the way that you think about these games. Obviously cover these games, so it should be exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. And we are here today to do with you, Ian, pretty much exactly what we did with you about 8 years ago after BB14. We talked through that whole experience from your point of view chronologically, and I think it's going to be, well, quite similar in a lot of ways. I think also potentially quite a bit different in other ways as well, where last time we were focused, I think, a lot on the very specific kind of game decision points, and while we certainly want to explore all of that in detail with you today for sure, I also think today there's going to be a lot more focus on just kind of big picture stuff and the evolution of you as a player and Big Brother as a show and just the growth that everyone has kind of undergone or potential decline, as in the case of the show, potentially, that everyone has undergone over the last 8 years. I think there is a lot more that just wouldn't be possible with a first-time Ian Terry. So I'm really excited for this opportunity to dive into everything. But first things first, welcome back to the real world. I guess it's been a couple of weeks for you at this point, kind of integrating back into life after so long in isolation. What is the experience like as like a mega recent Big Brother alumni in the year 2020 versus in the year 2012?
You know, that's actually a really good question. I would say that the main difference is obviously three things, right? One, viewership was obviously lower this time around. So, you know, I think it was like 6 or 7 million people watched Big Brother 14 about. It seems like this one was hovering in the mid high threes, low 4 mil region. So just less people on that front. I've been out of the country since coming back. I actually went to Cancun for a week just to get away from everything. So obviously I'm not getting recognized a ton when I'm in Cancun, a little bit, but not a whole lot by other tourists. And with COVID, you know, I'm not out and about as much as I would have been in 2012. So there is that factor. I'm just not going out of my house a huge amount as anyone socially responsible would, so or would not do. So with those and the fact I lasted only about half as long, not quite, but a little bit around there, you know, I'm going to get recognized a little bit less.
Yeah, you know, there's, I'm guessing, a pretty big difference between being on the TV episodes as one of about a dozen or so people in the house on average versus being the big underdog hero who wins it all in the end after being a main character for 12 weeks or whatever. But one area where things, where the experience at least potentially maybe also a bit different, is social media has come a long way in the 8 years since the last time you played. What has that been like compared to 2012?
Yeah, well, that's actually a really interesting question as well, because I'm not used to the whole, you know, I guess you could call it like stan culture, you know, people using my face as, you know, profile pictures on social media, just stuff like that. I you know, I find it a little bit different. It seems like Twitter was kind of popping off for Big Brother around Big Brother 14 and 15, I feel like. And, you know, I definitely got to the point where I could experience that, right? It wasn't like one of the seasons like, you know, 10 or 11 where it wasn't really being covered in like mainstream magazines, but it also was largely ignored by social media because social media at that point was like Facebook or maybe even MySpace, late MySpace. So, you know, I did get to experience Twitter, but it's a lot different now.
Yeah, sparing a thought for the late MySpace here, I think the topic of social media here is really an interesting one. And I know a lot of people pin a kind of inflection point in the way that especially Twitter has reacted to the show in BB16 with, you know, maybe Frankie Grande had an effect on that and so on. And if you're part of the crowd that has this unified theory of the show where BB16 just ruined every aspect of it, then it seems very easy to slot that in there. But there have always been kind of crazy obsessive Big Brother fans, even going back to the very early seasons, and it would be very common on, you know, the first All-Stars on the feed for contestants to talk about that. So as someone who has now played on both sides of that hypothetical turning point, and I know you're very close to some people who did play back then and people who have played since then, does that seem like the natural turning point, or is it just something that has evolved and changed over time and there's not really one thing you can attribute it to?
So Big Brother 16 being the big turning point?
Yes.
I actually did have this discussion with my girlfriend shortly before I left. I think there were two really big turning points in terms of social media and viewership. I think 16 really did pile on the younger crowd because of Frankie Grande's inclusion in the cast. I also feel like it seemed in 16 they kind of like really went hard for the silliness factor, if you will, right? Much more people getting slimed, people wearing, you know, frog costumes and dinosaur outfits, things like that. It seemed like they really went a little bit harder in Big Brother 16 compared to 15 and earlier. I think the other big turning point, though, is in terms of trying to get a younger audience, maybe not so much in social media, was Big Brother 11. I will never forget the day where I was, walking through my house. It was right before Big Brother 11 was set to start. My younger brother was watching something on Nickelodeon, which obviously, if you're outside the U.S., not familiar, that's a children's television channel marketed at people probably between the ages of 8 and, 14.
I'll take way the under. I'll say, 5 and 10.
I mean, I guess, there's, some shows that are...
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Audience, right?
I'll take the under on the low side, I guess. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. You're right about the 14.
Yeah, I mean, it probably depends on what time of day, I guess.
Yeah,
but
true.
I remember walking through the house. That's on. He's watching, I think it was Drake and Josh or something like that. And the commercials start, and there's an ad for Big Brother 11 on there. And I remember it says, one house, bunch of cameras. It's written in, flashy pink and black letters. There's splats of green slime on the screen. And then it says the wackiest and craziest competitions on TV, 12 house guests. And it, shows them making silly faces. And I was like, that's very odd. Why would a commercial for something that I view as at least, when I was growing up, a decidedly adult show air on Nickelodeon? Right. I mean, obviously it's Viacom, right? But it doesn't seem like that's the target audience for this program. So I felt like they in Big Brother 11 is when they really started to try to go ahead and get a younger audience in the mix.
So
did it seem like when you were in the house this time around that you and others were being more aware or vigilant maybe of how things you were doing and saying would be perceived on social media? I guess more in some cases than in others, but I think that's always a thing that you are aware of when the premise of the show is you are being filmed 24/7 and people are watching your every move, as the introduction goes. But was that, did that feel like more of a concern for you this time around than it did in BB14? And if so, how much of that do you think was the changing climate around that sort of thing versus just, all-stars versus non-all-stars and coming into the game with a different mindset anyway?
Yeah, I think I was pretty aware of the cameras in terms of, what I can say, what should be, topics that would be discussed. Really didn't want to, I would shy away from certain topics. As far as social media goes, I mean, for me, it's not that big of a difference because I would consider myself a fairly woke guy. So it's not like I need to put up a big facade, but, I think that others maybe were a little bit more cognizant of that. And I do think it was, returning players, you kind of have some idea, although that's a little bit different because some of them were pre-social media. So some are not used to that idea. And, I've had conversations with some players where they're like, it wasn't like this last time now that we're out of the house. And, frankly, I think that I think everyone kind of knows to be a little bit careful, although, maybe on the results end, it doesn't seem that way.
I think it'd be difficult for anyone who wasn't playing on a very recent season to be prepared for the difference in social media between now and whenever their first time was. But I also wanted to circle back to something that I thought could potentially be not totally distinct to you, but you could be one of a very few people potentially who on their second time around potentially was less prepared for certain elements than they were on their first time around. Because I was thinking back to this time 8 years ago when we were at the beginning of this podcast talking about your experience as a fan growing up, and you were discussing sneaking episodes of BB2 because it was adult content back when you were a young 12, 13 year old boy or whatever. And entering BB14, you were a super fan. You'd seen all the seasons probably repeatedly, and you know, famously could rattle off the entire boot list of every season ever while you were in the house. This time around, I believe it is the case that at least prior to getting the word that you might be back in the house, you hadn't really been watching the recent seasons too much. Maybe I'm speaking totally out of school here, but I think it is at least possible in some respects that there could be areas where this time around you felt potentially less prepared than you did as a first timer. Is that accurate, or did you feel like as a veteran you were just much more comfortable in pretty much every way?
Yeah, I definitely think there were some parts, and I didn't really realize it until I was in the house in certain situations, which I'm sure will come up, in which I did feel a little bit less prepared than, say, I guess a good person would be like Tyler, right? I have not watched any of Big Brother 20 or Big Brother 21. I guess Big Brother 20, I saw zero episodes, absolutely none. Big Brother 21, I saw the second half of the first episode and then maybe like the first third of the second episode, because I was a little bit curious about this. You know, I saw on Twitter like camp director, I was like, oh, this, I want to see where they're going with this. I like to see what the twist is, just to kind of you know, evaluate it from you know, is this a good twist, whoever came up with this, is from a game theory point of view, how does this affect the game? And I saw that, but after the elimination with the dark room, I was like, yeah, I think I'm good on Big Brother this year. So did not watch 21 at all. And as far as 19 goes, I watched about the first, I don't know, 3 weeks religiously, and then around week 4 or 5, filthy casual, maybe the eviction episodes, and then after that, just gave up on it entirely. So really had not seen any of the most recent seasons. The last one where I was fully bought in was Big Brother 18, and that was because obviously Frank was on there, Nicole was on there, and you know, Meech was on there. So, you know,
so, one of these is not like the others. Yeah.
Right. One of those is a little bit different than the other ones. So that, you know, that being said, that was the last time I was really fully bought in. I did watch Celebrity Big Brother 1 because I thought the concept was interesting. And obviously I knew that I was going to do the winner's panel appearance. So I was like, well, obviously I'm going to want to watch so I have some idea of what I'm talking about, but even with that I was a filthy casual.
Yeah, I certainly that? Sorry, quickly, just I don't mean to suggest that you are alone in falling out of love with a reality show that you were once on and will return to again someday, and I don't mean to suggest that you're like Colby and Heroes versus Villains out there. But I did think it was at least potentially meaningful that there were some areas of the game that have evolved since the last time you or any of us were really paying close attention.
Yeah. Was there a kind of mismatch in the house as well, where if the people who had studied up enough to have watched your first season saw you be the super fan of all super fans and probably would assume that had carried forward to the present day? And so, you know, Tyler, if he's done his homework, is coming in there thinking, okay, Ian probably knows everything about who I am, he's got this dossier on me, he maybe knows me and my game better than I know those things myself. And you're like, who is this blonde surfer guy? I don't know her.
So yes, this is actually a very good point. And I did look this up after, and it did come up in jury house in discussions as well. So as far as what I did specifically to kind of, you know, clean up the fact I hadn't seen the vast majority of 19 and basically none of 20 or 21, I did just go ahead and read the articles on Wikipedia, just so that I had some idea of what the twists were, you know, maybe the style with which production was going, as far as things like that went, and then took a look at who did well and looked up a cast photo of each one of those casts. So at least I would know everyone's name if I was in there. So, you know, I would see Tyler and be like, this guy is Tyler, this person is Bailey, this is Nicole, A, David, whoever. That way I at least had familiarity with who everyone was. And I figured that just reading the Wikipedia article would probably be enough. I think what was actually kind of funny is that in the house, I said I did not watch Big Brother 20 or 21 or most of 19. Not a damn person believed that. They did assume that I was lying about that. I mean, I guess it's pretty plausible, but no, I was actually being honest. I said in the jury house, I was like, no, I actually did not watch Big Brother 20. And the thing that was kind of funny was because I had read the Wikipedia article, I probably could maybe on a bet rattle off like the Big Brother 20 boot order, right? Just because I read the article once. I don't want to try it on air, but I probably would be pretty close.
What are we
to
betting?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, put some money on it, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I probably could get it right, maybe with like a couple weeks flip-flopped or something like that. And I was, again, familiar with the twists. That's really what I was looking for, just to see how the game has kind of evolved. And you know, what if there is some sort of mystery twist, which we will get into quite a lot later, what kinds of things, what is the spectrum of which that could that twist could be, right? Twist, if there's a mystery power, that can be anything on the scale of a chip redraw for Vito, which is basically useless, to a coup d'etat, you know, in Big Brother 11 and 7, which is, I mean, so overpowered that it's almost absurd. So just having an idea of what the range is, I felt would be useful to me. So they did think I watched the more recent seasons. I did not. I just read the Wikipedia article, and I actually looked at a lot of those Wikipedia articles prior to coming in. And I think what was kind of sick nasty was that I, just from reading those, remembered details of people's own seasons better than they did. I think like a prime example of this was I was trying to build some sort of social bond with Enzo during the week he was HOH. And I realized that Big Brother 12 was definitely 75 days, and my season was 75 days. So we were going to hit that 100-day mark during that week. So I went up to Enzo and I said, hey, you know, we're going to have our 100th day in here on Sunday or whatever. Maybe we should, you know, chug a beer and, you know, Century Club, right? 100 days, just because this seems like the type of thing that would appeal to Enzo. So he says to me, he's like, my season was 90 days. I passed it up a long time ago. And I'm sitting there in the back of my mind, I'm like, no, it was definitely 75 days, but I'm not about to correct him on it.
It feels like that anecdote would confirm everything that Enzo probably thought about you coming into the season, right?
Right, but, exactly.
I think there is an interesting larger discussion to be had about the metagame of being a superfan. And you were a big part of that, I think, back in your first season, where around that time, you know, you had you winning Big Brother and then Cochran winning Survivor in the course of, you know, a calendar year. And then it felt like around the same time, the idea of the superfan became this rigidly defined casting archetype that they kind of penciled in someone for that category every Big Brother season, every Survivor season for at least a few years. And then maybe the pendulum kind of swung a bit back in the other direction where those people were being cast a little less and succeeding less when they did get cast. And right. There were still super fans doing well, but they were people who maybe didn't quite fit the exact same mold, like Tyler, for instance, or other people who, just looking at them, knowing how casting tends to work, you wouldn't think, okay, this person is just there to tick the super fan box.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it did sort of migrate away from guy with glasses and watches the show quite a lot to a little bit more of a, you know, diverse, is that the right word? Not quite, but I think that, you know, a wider range perhaps of super fan archetypes. Yeah, I think that's a very fair point.
So when did you first get a call, or however they contact you these days? I assume no one answers their phone. At least I don't. It's from random numbers. When did this start feeling like a reality to you, the idea of going back as at least an option on the table, and how interested were you?
April. And how interested I was, well, I guess we can go into that. So basically, where I was in April, I was working as a consulting analyst, and obviously with COVID, shifted to a work from home setup. The thing about consulting for me is that the main perk of it is it should be either the work is interesting, because you're studying things, quantifiable things, and making decisions based on that mathematical calculations, which I find that extremely interesting. Or if the work isn't interesting, you at least get travel, right? You can travel to different cities, you can go to cool cities, see different places. Where I was in April, obviously in the COVID world, traveling is not happening. So that's off the table. And the work I was doing in April was from home, was not interesting. I felt like working a lot more hours. I felt like the work from home kind of shifted things to a point where, I was working probably about 8 a.m. to, 1 a.m. on any given day. Yeah. So I was like, this just is something that, I'm sitting there and I was like, look, if Big Brother's buying, I'm flying. So I said, this is a nice welcome escape. And, I'll go ahead and go for it. Couple of things, I figured that, it would only be sporting to accept the offer to go on and play again. I really feel like I actually feel like any one-time winner that gets called, it doesn't really sit right with me to decline the offer. I mean, obviously people have different things going on in their life, but for me, I just said, all right, look, you gotta go play. It's just I felt like obligated to do it almost.
What did you anticipate the meta around you in a random kind of all-star cast back in April when this is all hypothetical and you don't have a real clear idea of who you might be playing against, which may become a bit more clear over time. We will get a bit more into that potentially. Yeah. But when you were just thinking in the early days, how might this look for me as a returnee that people know of as a former winner? What were you expecting the reaction to you to be as an all-star?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me in April, my base assumptions were that the season's cast was going to be heavily favored towards recency bias. I expected there'd probably be at least three people each from 21, maybe even more than that from 20, because I heard that was a banger of a season. Maybe a few other winners. I thought maybe at most four or five previous winners. The list that I had down for that one, I pretty much assumed that Dan and Derek would definitely be there. And then I figured that Josh and Casey would be as well. So those were the winners that I kind of expected to be there. Definitely figured that with a tendency towards recency bias, I felt like I was not going to be in a great spot as far as table draw goes. I said to a very high level backgammon player, and I'll get into that when I'm talking about preparation for the season. I said, as far as table draw goes, I don't think this is going to be very good, because my assumption is that the players that I know, right, from my era of playing are people that I really don't have great meta with. And then the newer players who I do not know at all are going to band together ostensibly to take out the older school players. And I'm probably just going to be someone who doesn't really get in with either group or doesn't really get along with either group and could be an early casualty. So I sort of expected that this was not going to be a premium setup just going in. But I said, you know, that's fine, honestly, because just the way, just the payout structure of Big Brother is such that, and this is one of the things Big Brother really does right, is that 16th place and third place pay the same pretty much. So placement isn't really something that's a thought. It really just matters, do I win, come in second, or get evicted?
So what were your goals this time around as someone who has won the game before and as someone who obviously recognizes that there's no real monetary difference between last place and third place? What were you hoping to accomplish this time around?
Win. Anything other than win was just something I would just deem as like a waste of time, basically.
So no considerations ever of this play might get me further. It's all about what improves my first place equity only.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. For me, I think about it. I actually think about it like this. If we want to talk about that, I said to a few people before I left, the worst possible place to come in would be 11th place.
you just manifested that. That was unwise. You should have said the worst thing that could have happened would be for me to win again, and then the universe would have conspired to deliver that for you.
I said to a handful of people before I left, I said the worst place would be 11th. I think that it was basically, I didn't want to be the first juror, and I didn't want to be the first one out, right? And that was kind of just my thought process here. Was I didn't want to be the first boot, you know, just for obvious reasons. And I didn't want to be the first person in jury because that's like the worst possible placement, which obviously placement doesn't mean anything to me, but I do know that the viewers tend to get placement-itis, as I call it, where they look at that and somehow make a judgment as to the strength of one's play based on that. And I figure it's the worst possible placement where you then have to be there the entire time. Obviously, if you make jury, you do get, a little bit more. But the question is it really worth it? And the answer for me is no.
Well, with that in mind then, because knowing that, by that metric, if anything other than first place is basically the same as last place, and then monetarily, you know, a lot of those places in between are basically identical. Does it make sense, just strictly on those terms, to come back? Unless you really value the experience of playing Big Brother and being in there with the type of people that you expect to be in there with. Because it seems like for a lot of people who maybe could have been on the season how they wanted to be, that might be a factor, right? Like if you're there purely to win, knowing how remote those chances are and the fact that you've won before makes it even more remote in all likelihood, then it seems like that kind of life value judgment weighs heavily on the side of just saying no, of turning it down.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, again, I feel like I have to. I mean, it's just, when I get that call, it's not necessarily like a drop everything, but like I wasn't really satisfied with the work that I was doing at the time. And frankly, it seemed like a nice chance to just escape from, you know, the COVID world, you know, that is 2020. And on top of that, you know, I just can't turn down free equity. I mean, it's plus EV. It's plus EV, really, no matter how it shakes out. So I just can't turn that down.
I mean, we don't need to get into the specifics, but rumors circulated that you guys were not playing just for free off the bat, and that there may have been some additional payments beyond the norm, but not super relevant to this conversation necessarily.
Without going into it, oops, sorry.
No, go for it.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I'm not going to go ahead and throw numbers out there, but there is a Twitter post that pretty accurately details how much everybody ended up walking away with.
Okay. So let's get into your pregame preparation here. I'm very interested in finding out more about this consultation with a high-level backgammon player.
Yeah. So basically the way that I thought about preseason, I would say there are just a handful of things that I did. I already mentioned I read the Wikipedia articles and looked up like a cast photo with names for the seasons that I didn't see. That was just to kind of like get a ground level idea, or sorry, a high level idea, not anything too detailed, a high level idea of what to kind of expect and see the way that the game has drifted in terms of overall structure. I know that one of the things that I've seen come up is apparently the competition structure towards the end game has changed. That was something I really didn't know about when I was in the house, and I've read up on after getting out. But just seeing like the twist structure, you know, what's the way that you know they shake up the game? What are they tending to do? I looked that up. That was the main goal of those Wikipedia reads. Now, as far as preparation goes, I would say one of the first things I did was I went back and listened to the pre-recording of Survivor's Second Chances with Spencer Bledsoe that y'all did when he was in the hotel room the night before. He pretty much knew he was a lock to get voted onto the cast and was about to head out there, just to see what to expect as far as you know, pre-game alliance building, if you will, right? I knew that on Big Brother 7, that was obviously something that was a heavy part of that season. And I did know, just through discussions with people that were on that season and hanging out with Danielle Reyes at a brunch where it was me, her, Peter Brown, Joel from Big Brother Canada for I think that there might have been one other person from Big Brother there. Can't remember who. And then Robin Cass. I do remember that Danielle Reyes said to Robin during that brunch, we were not allowed to contact any players and have those discussions. It was explicitly in the rules that you could not do that. And Danielle said to Robin, I was the only one who followed that instruction. And I think we do kind of see that crop up in Big Brother 7, where she does, you know, she does face the early nomination because she gets a little antsy with the whole, you know, make the HOHs not agree thing. But, you know, I'm sure that the fact that she was coming in there fresh and everyone else had pre-gamed a bit, you know, likely was something that contributed to that occurring.
It's so, also, it, sorry, quickly to jump in. I hadn't thought about this, but in BB7, they were doing open campaigning. They knew who the candidates were to be in the house.
Correct. So, you know, obviously, you know, there's a pretty narrow pool of people that I'm assuming will get selected. I listened to the Spencer pregame podcast that y'all did, and it seemed to me that it was any sort of texting that he was doing based on that was like, oh, you know, I think you have a good shot. Good luck. Nothing solid, right? And I kind of figured that, one, aside from the fact that it was explicitly mentioned, do not contact other possible house guests, and then combined with hearing that from Survivor, I was like, I really don't think that heavily pre-gaming this is going to be anything that I need to do in order to ensure success. I didn't think that that was really going to play a huge factor in things. You know, I see explicitly do not contact other contestants, and my brain says, all right, let's just play by the rules. This isn't like, you know, when we say lie, cheat, and steal, we're using cheat a little bit, you know, liberally. So I said, if it's against the rules, I won't do it. And whatever happens with that is fine. I'll deal with the consequences of that.
And ultimately, how much of a role do you feel like pre-gaming played on this season, and do you regret potentially not going harder in that department?
Yeah, I think pre-gaming definitely played a role, and I do regret not going harder in that department. It just seemed to me like, based on what I heard from the Survivor, because I figured that was more relevant than the first Big Brother All-Stars, I felt like with what I had heard about Survivor Second Chances, the extent of pre-gaming there, and then it just basically, it was literally in the rules. Don't do it. So I figured, you know, I'm not going to do it. And it turns out that it it had a pretty large effect on the game from everything I understand post-show.
So I don't want to ask about, honestly, any more than one specific person who was not on the final cast. And you are welcome to pass on this question if you are so inclined. But I would personally be curious to know if you heard from specifically Derek Levasseur at all.
I never heard from Derek. I'll go ahead and tell you exactly the pregame conversations that I had with any person who was on Big Brother. I'll go ahead and tell you, because for me, it was don't set up alliances. And my whole thing was, I'll talk about the backgammon player consultation, and then I'll talk about this. I think about, like, oh, I haven't watched the show in recent years, but I know people that have, and I know people that have that are also good Big Brother players and also unlikely to be there in my mind. So I asked Andy Herron for advice and Eric Stein for advice. Like, what's the show like now? What's the deal with what's this twist, the power app room? What was the deal with this? How did this play out outside of just what I can read on Wikipedia? So I asked them for advice, not setting up alliances, but just hey, familiarize me. How do you play the game? Because I think those two are probably, a lot of people disagree with this, but I think that those two are really the ones that are at the forefront of playing Big Brother well. I think they are, from the way I evaluate things, probably the two best players, and I feel like those are the ones to ask.
I definitely would sign off on them being very worthwhile people with whom to check in, and I think that is certainly, if you potentially even a better use of your time than actually sitting there and watching the seasons yourselves, is just save yourself the 60 plus hours or whatever it would take to watch those two seasons or so, and just ask smart people who've already done that kind of time investment what conclusions they came away with. One other thing. Yeah, sorry, go ahead. So,
yeah, there was no – I want to go ahead and say this. No point in preseason did I ever consider watching Big Brother 2021 or the half of 19 that I missed. That was absolutely off the table.
So in terms of just bigger picture strategy, sorry, whoever I'm cutting off right now, I believe it is the case that the overall game plan was to just kind of like hang back for a while and then eventually get to a point where you could hopefully win a bunch of competitions again and then make it to the end. Did you have a specific point in mind?
Yeah, I did, actually. The week after I ended up getting evicted, week 7, I felt like halfway seemed about right. I will say there were times in which I was willing to deviate from that strategy. Because, and I'll talk about this when we get into it, but I had kind of toyed around with some quantifiable ideas with HOH wins, and one of those is what I called efficiency. And I did feel like there was one HOH in particular that I felt would have been efficient, two of them that I felt would have been really efficient times to win HOH, and we'll get into that later. Well, there's two very different sets of circumstances that led to me not winning those, one of which I end up throwing. So, I think that that's something that will come back. So I was willing to deviate, but that was sort of an overarching idea that I had in mind. I want to go ahead and state, I was never at any point playing for what I call the slime equity. We talk about this in backgammon. You get hit, you get primed in or something, and then, some really, really weird sequence where you sneak your check around the board, rip some doubles, and then win. I was never playing for competition slime equity when I was in there, but I did know that it certainly is something that exists, and it is something that I had to take into consideration in a lot of decisions that I made, because, like I said, if your goal is to win, a lot of it comes down to, well, I could make this play, but if I do this and then go, I'm sacktowning that equity. How much is that worth?
Right.
You know, that has to come into play in decision making. But I'm never sitting there and thinking, all right, well, I just need to make it to top eight and then I'm going to win. I did tell the, you know, when I had the high level consultation with Backgammon Player and I discussed what my odds realistically would be, I said that it just depends on progression. And I said, if I'm around in final six or seven, you may as well just call it even money. I figured as much. And I don't feel like that. The seeing what the competitions were around final six, I don't feel like that's inaccurate. But the strategy is generally to lay back. Sort of the way that I think of Big Brother and the way that I view how Big Brother should be played is really all anyone is ever doing when they're playing Big Brother is just playing the odds. You know, the way I think of it is in round one, you have 16 people that can win HOH and 16 people that can win Veto. The game could take any one of 256 different paths. And some of those paths are weighted more heavily than others. But you just have to look at it like, I'm just trying to minimize the sequences that end with me being eliminated in any given round or later in the game. That's all Big Brother really is when it comes down to it. And I'm just going to shuffle the checkers around the board in order to make sure that those sequences are avoided.
So I want to both give you credit and take a stab here at something that you just brought up, which is believing in high efficiency HOH weeks versus lower efficiency HOH weeks, which I think is both absolutely a thing and a very good way of framing it. I want to give you credit for all the way back years and years ago, in 2012, you were someone who, as idiots like me, were talking about how what a genius Will Kirby was for throwing every single competition, and Dan Giesling, throwing so many competitions and never needing any power of his own and just being able to get people to do what they want. Well, I think there is some fundamental truth.
Oh, there's certainly value there.
there's definitely value there, but you were a very early adopter of the power of the week one HOH being potentially a very good thing that a lot of people were potentially overlooking many years ago. And I think that has become something that has become a lot more mainstream, is the understanding of, especially in seasons where the week one HOH gets almost two full weeks to themselves.
Yeah.
What were your thoughts this time around on the week one HOH? Because I was wondering if this was potentially one of the competitions you threw.
Absolutely. No. Definitely did not throw this one. I do kind of want to go ahead. I don't want to move into it too much, but no, the first HOH was definitely one that I was gunning for.
Okay.
I absolutely wanted that first HOH. I think that is an extremely high efficiency HOH to win. You basically get to choose who you want to work with for the rest of the game. You can pretty much have your hand pick of the alliance that you want and consolidate a group around you. So definitely wanted that first HOH. That is one of four competitions that I put 100% full effort into on this season, and I thought it was extremely efficient. Now, as far as preseason goes, I would say the other preseason things that I did do was I went ahead and I read probably one of my favorite books on just strategic thinking. That is Games of Strategy. It's a game theory textbook, technically, that I had for a course that I took at Tulane. It's by Dixit, Skeith, and Riley, I believe. And the book is really solid. Conceptually, there's a few chapters in particular that are really, really useful for Big Brother as far as, you know, the idea of credible threats, you know, brinkmanship, like they do like this in-depth study of that. You can get by without the Calc 3. They discuss sequential games. Like they have an entire part of a chapter devoted on the final three situation in Survivor Borneo. It's a really good book. Anyone that's going on one of these shows should check that out. So I went ahead and read that again. If you don't know Calc 3, you can just ignore the math parts. But what I do like is that, and then I have this idea of talking to a high-level backgammon player. So I don't want to give away this person's identity, but I will say they do not watch Big Brother. They have never seen a single episode of Big Brother. However, they apparently, I didn't know until the time, they religiously watch Survivor. So
this sounds a lot like Colin to me. Just
world class backgammon expert.
Yeah. So I didn't know that they watched Survivor. So I basically said, all right, here's what Big Brother is. Here's the rule set. I said this is the way it works. And I said, looking at this, and I also mentioned, keep in mind that the end game does tend to favor memory competitions, so I have some equity involved there. What would you say, based on this rule set, is the optimal idea going into this? And the thing he said to me was, since the HOH decides the nominations, the main idea is you don't have to be anyone's number one priority. All you have to do is not be one or two on someone's shit list. And I thought that was pretty accurate.
Yes. That, I feel like, for the first, I don't know, at least decade and a half of Big Brother's run was kind of like the underlying strategy. I know Andy Heron based his whole game plan around, what do I have to do to make sure that no matter what happens, no matter how the competitions fall over the next couple of weeks, I am not going to get nominated. I'm not going to be in anyone's top three people that they want to see leave. And that's always how I've thought about it as well. And I, in preparation for this interview, listened to Taryn Armstrong's interview with Cody over on RHAP. And I thought it was fascinating to hear Cody say one thing in particular, and I would love to get your take on this. And maybe this was just kind of an offhand remark on Cody's end, and I'm reading way too much into it. But at some point along the way there, he said, you know, in Big Brother, if you're not staying in people's top three or top four closest allies, you're liable to go up any given week. Ian, are we at the point now in modern Big Brother with all of the, I mean, we can absolutely bank on there being multiple twists just falling from the sky every single season from now until eternity, or, you know, until the show's over, more or less. Are we at the point where just what we think of as Big Brother is no longer the case? Like, has the game just passed us by?
Yeah, I think it has. I mean, for me, that, you know, like I said, I went in with this underlying assumption. I do not need to be anyone's number one priority, at least for like the first, you know, front half to two thirds of the game. I went into this idea, as long as I'm not that high on the shit list, then I'm in good shape. Apparently, it is tough to say, right? Because I will get into this twist pre-reading that I had looked into, and how I would account for twists. But yeah, I mean, it does seem to me like there is sort of this fundamental shift. And this is something maybe I didn't pick up on because I hadn't seen the recent seasons. But like, yeah, I mean, for me, you know, what I'm drawing from really is Big Brother 2 through, I don't know, I'd say 16 is when I was really, really, you know, really, really watching the show, 18 as well. And, you know, that's where I'm really looking at the game. And for me, I do have this tendency to play in a way where the idea is, as long as you're not on someone's shit list or at the tip top of it, you're in good standing. And I do think that there is, because of twists, but we'll get into that. Yeah, maybe this is the right idea.
Yeah, let me just quickly
state, if you can be high on everyone's priority list, that's great. But I mean, the way that I think of it, the way that I've always thought of it since I was 10 years old is you just got to be, not number one on that list.
Let me just quickly state, sorry, Dom, I know you have a question you are dying to ask, but let me just quickly state for the record in case anyone was unclear on this. Big Brother has 100% passed me by. I am out to pasture for sure.
Yeah, and I would say the same thing. I really, I think there were remarks that, on Twitter, because I did go and take a look. It was like, man, Ian just seems like he really does not even want to be there. And I was definitely feeling that at times. I was just sitting there and I was like, what is this? You know, this is not the Big Brother that I know and, that I grew up with. I'm definitely quite jaded as far as the game and the show goes. I have not watched recent seasons. I don't keep up with it. Did I want to be there? Yeah, but there were definitely times where I was like, this is not what I grew up watching.
So with this idea of just not being at the top of anyone's hit list, I wonder if you can tie this back to that idea that BB16 kind of changed everything in terms of giving the blueprint for the best way to play Big Brother with the type of people that they cast nowadays of you just need to get this kind of big supermajority together and you have this charismatic leader at the center of that who kind of keeps everybody in line, keeps all of the outer spokes where he or she wants them, and you just whittle down everybody else until it gets down to your group, and then you let the outer rings of that kind of fight each other, and you're always at the center, always immune from any backlash or criticism.
Theory, right? Yeah, I actually, yeah. I thought about this. In terms of Survivor, I think that Onion Theory is pretty on the mark.
On the Marcus?
Sure. Yeah. Very good. Very nice. I think that that's a really strong idea. I think that in Big Brother, it works to an extent, and sometimes it will work, but it does seem like things just break down and just go to shreds a fair amount of the time. And the reason is just that in Big Brother, there are two competitions a week, one of which will heavily dictate the direction that week goes. And like we're talking with efficiency, one efficient HOH win will cause a large alliance to just absolutely crumble. Everyone's going to start throwing each other under the bus. And it more or less just becomes this, complete shambled mess race to the end where, it's very fractured. There's a lot of play for people that aren't in that alliance.
So from your kind of insider's perspective there, how susceptible do you think the kind of a committee plus, if you like, would have been to that kind of outside attack? Like if you had managed to win one of those late HOHs, or if David had come out of nowhere and spiked one towards the end, do you think that we would have seen, Danny versus Nicole versus all of these different elements of the alliance? Do you think they could have survived that, even though it might have been more of a challenge than Cody, let's say, ever really faced in the season as it happened?
Absolutely. I think that the thing that is interesting is if you told me, in the early goings, the exact makeup of that group, I probably would have chuckled and said, yeah, that's gonna last. That group is incredibly wolfy. Wolfie's gonna wolf, as we called the first episode of the Genius Grand Final. that's just the reality of it. I think an outside HOH, if Dave on spikes that week five HOH, that is gonna be hilarious. I mean the effect of that, I mean, that would have changed the entire course of the season, in my opinion.
Tipping point for you?
I think that, I'd say the big, big tipping point for me was probably just a little bit before that, maybe about an hour, not even an hour, maybe about a half an hour before that competition's outcome became clear. I think that was basically the point of no return, if you will.
Because in BB14, it felt like the early stages of that game, at least as a viewer, were highly chaotic. And it really did feel like basically anything could happen at any time. And then that lasted until, I would say, the mid mid-jury phase of the game where you started to see this this big majority alliance come together. But even then, there was a question of who was really at the core of that. Like, you had the Quack Pack, but then also Frank and Boogie thought they were in good with that. And then you had events like Frank's HOH week leading to Dan's funeral, and then that kind of blew things wide open. So it felt like there was a lot more room for that game to go any way at any time. Yep. Whereas this one was almost like the platonic ideal of that Derek Clavassa blueprint, right?
Yeah, correct.
The same way that your Boston Robin Redemption Island or your Kim in One World, you will never get a game as kind of like inevitable as that one felt. Again, did that create a very different vibe being at the center of that, where, you know, when if you felt in danger in BB14, was that a different feeling than feeling in danger in this season?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think realistically, the way you can look at this season and sort of make this comparison of Big Brother Survivor, the Big Alliance idea where you just shed the outer rings. In Survivor, the reason that Onion Theory is so strong in Survivor is that there is one immunity challenge. One person will be immune. If the person who is on the outermost ring wins, you just go for the next person. In Big Brother, this is a good example right here in terms of like a very, what should have been a very efficient HOH win is Big Brother 14, week three, it's effectively 6-on-2, right? With the two outside players being Danielle and Shane, and then the six being me, Will, Joe, Frank, Ashley, and Jen, right? Boogie said it best, like right after that HOH, he said, the second that Shane's ball went into the 20 slot on that hockey rink, that alliance of six was done. Over. The game is anew.
I feel like BB14 had several competitions with both Shane and Frank kind of throwing a complete monkey wrench into everything.
Correct. So you're going to have these more volatile situations where – like this is, I mean, it's a complete reset. It is Big Brother is a lot like backgammon in that you just have, you know, you might be 75% to win, 78% to win, 80% to win for plies and plies and plies in a row. Then you roll the weird number, the shot gets left, it hits, and then it just swings, boom, all the way the other direction. So keeping that in mind, There's a key difference here. Now, in terms of this season, it functions pretty much almost identically to how a season of Survivor would, in that if only one group ever gets HOH, they can just effectively pick off the outer ring at leisure, right? In Big Brother, you will lose people in that alliance. It could be the core of the alliance that gets lost if an outsider wins HOH. I know for me, if I win the HOH in week five, I know Cody is going up and I know he's the target. So, you know, that will happen. Things like that, people that are in the inner core, the head of these alliances, will go up in situations where outsiders win HOH. You know, obviously will Cody go? Probably not. But someone that's in the inner ring is going to go. That's why I always advocate for in Big Brother, it's you may not even want to be, you know, at least in old school theory, you might not want to be at the tip top of the alliance. You probably want to be in the middle or low end, because if that outsider gets it, you don't want to be the one that's under the heat.
Totally.
Was it always clear to you that it was Cody who was at the core of that? And do you feel like not being part of that inner circle almost give you a clarity about that, the people who were in that lap, where I'm sure at various points, if you had asked, you know, Nicole or Danny or Enzo, maybe even Tyler, all of them might have thought at one point that they were running the alliance. Whereas if you are on the outside of that, and you're kind of tuned into what's going on, then it seemed like it was always clear that, yeah, it's Cody at the top. And then I'm not quite sure who the second in command is exactly, but we know who the number one slot is.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, it just seemed to me, at least, just because he was the first HOH, you kind of knew that he was in the thick of whatever it was. Obviously, I don't know the exact makeup. I don't know, you know, this four prime thing, which I'll get into that. There seems to be a lot of stuff online that is simply inaccurate about where I felt my standing was. I don't know what DRs aired. I don't know if me muttering around the house was ever on feed about how I did not like this position and I did not like working with this group because I felt like I was getting jerked around. But I kind of knew that he was probably the person who was in the thick of things simply just based on the fact he was H2H1 and got to consolidate the power.
So when you are finally now on your way, knowing we're about to start, it's day one, the game kicks off tonight, I assume you don't know the full cast list at that point.
Obviously, no idea, no idea.
Who are you really hoping to see out there, and who are you really hoping to not see out there?
I think for me, I'm looking to see, in an ideal world, I think Johnny Mac would have been fun. That's someone I could definitely work with. I was hoping to see Danielle Reyes. I was definitely hoping Danielle Reyes would be in the mix. Would have loved to have worked with her. I mean, if she's in there, I'm basically on night one, just like, we gotta work together. This is like that. That's like, 11 years old dream sequence, mm-hmm. So definitely was hoping to see her. Danielle Donato, I was actually, the prospect of playing with Danielle Donato was something that I thought was really interesting because, like I said, I was still that was still pretty early in terms of BB, and I do really get a kick out of this idea of, I'm 15 years old, 16 years old, whatever, watching Showtime After Dark, and there's Danielle Donato on there, and the idea of I'm currently sitting in the Big Brother house, 14, however many years later, that was what, 13 years later, playing with that person is just cool to me. I like that idea. I just pretty much assumed Tyler was going to be there. I assumed Josh was going to be there. I assumed Derek was going to be there. And though I wasn't thrilled about the prospect, I pretty much assumed that Dan and Janelle would be there as well.
And how were you feeling about your relationship entering a theoretical all-star season with either of Dan or Janelle?
Not so hot. I talked to a friend of mine who was not on Big Brother but does follow the show. And pretty much the idea was if Dan is in there, the goal is going to be to just dunk on you at any just for his street cred, right?
Did you feel like that, Memphis was given a mission to dunk? I definitely got that vibe.
100%. I mean, there's no question about it. And obviously this idea will come up quite a bit. But yeah, 100%. I mean, I said it so much on feeds. Like, if he is there, his mission is not to win. His mission is to just make sure that I go out in like a quick fashion. Janelle, if she's there and he's there, they're definitely my idea is they're definitely going to be in cahoots. And that's someone to watch out for. Derek as well. So really going into it, conversations with Eric, and this is what I had said. I felt like it was going to be modern. I felt like it was going to be old. And then I felt like I was basically not going to be accepted by either group and was going to have problems as far as table draw went.
And in terms of how things actually went with Janelle, was that basically what you were expecting?
No, that ended up being, and we'll get into things with this, but I felt like that it's tough because with Memphis, that was pretty much dead on correct. With Janelle, it seemed like there was more openness to actually work with me. However, I will get into, and I stated actually in the eviction interview, why I had quite a bit of hesitation to work with her. In those early goings, and how exactly that came about. But yeah, that with Memphis, it was exactly as I expected. With Janelle, it was pretty much the opposite. I think that was a mistake. I think there was almost overcorrection there.
And I definitely, I'm sure we will get more into this, but when you actually do see the final cast there, and I was wondering if this potentially played a role in developing a surprisingly more amicable relationship inside the house with Janelle than you were anticipating. Was that same effect that you talked about with Danielle Reyes and, oh my God, my 11-year-old self would be freaking out right now? Did you feel that about Kacer?
Absolutely. 100%. And with Kacer, there's another interesting layer to this. So when I see Kacer sitting on the couch, the immediate thing that my brain says is like, oh, holy shit, it's Kacer? Like, how is this even possible? I think that there are three people on this cast that basically have no business playing modern Big Brother as it stands. And those three people are me, Kacer, and Janelle. Just in terms of where he is at as a professional, where I am and where she is, it just does not make a ton of sense. This is, we are not Instagram social media influencers, though I will put forth some attempt now, but a half-hearted one at that. But I will say, like, we are not the mold of what modern Big Brother players are. Kacer, I mean, the concept that, if Janelle wins the first safety suite, the idea of Kacer walking around in a giant star costume is just patently absurd to me. it just does not fit. He does not, none of those three people fit on the Big Brother, 16 plus. Get it? Like, Kacer getting slimed, like, it just seems ridiculous to me.
Yeah.
What? Like, the idea that a biotech executive that drives two Teslas is it just doesn't make a ton of sense.
So, not at least initially stoked to see Janelle or Memphis out there when you walk onto the stage.
Yeah.
Blown away
yeah.
to see Kacer. Overall, when you see the final cast, I guess you only saw a few people at first, but after everyone's inside the house, what did you think about the table draw in front of you?
Pretty bad. I thought this was it was better than I anticipated, but it was still pretty ass. I think the moment where I really realized how screwed I was going to be was it didn't fully register who was in and who was out, because like we were coming down in waves, right? And we were with like an initial group of three or a group of four, and I saw three other people. It took me a few minutes to realize, oh, wait, Josh isn't here. Oh, wait, Casey isn't here. Derek's not here. It took me a little bit of time just because I was in this state of shell shock, really, where I basically was looking around and I see Nicole F. And she says to me, so we're the only winners here, right? And then, I mean, at that point, my heart basically just sunk. I mean, I was like, oh, man, is this really the setup? Is this really how this is going to play out? Me and her are the only winners here. This is about as bad as it could possibly get on that front. This is not Big Brother 14, where I get cushion weeks at the beginning. This is not Big Brother 7, where there's one winner as opposed to two, which is probably the worst number possible in a game of Big Brother, just because that's how many people get nominated in a given round. It's not even like Casey is there as like a scarier winner, or in Josh to be loud and, make himself a target. I mean, this is pretty horrible. I know full well if that winner nomination set comes along, I am going to be perceived as the scarier of the two, and my game is over and done with.
Yeah, I definitely feel like those are some pretty valid concerns there. And on night one here, I suspect that pretty close to 100% of people who have ever gone into the Big Brother house in any season in any country have been nervous on night one for one reason or another. On BB22, did those nerves feel noticeably different than the kind of nerves you had on BB14?
Yes. I think for me, it was very, very interesting. So without going a ton into the pre-sequester quarantine, period, I basically was pretty much just chilling in a pool, for like 9 hours a day, getting a tan. And then at night I'd watch The Simpsons. And pretty much the entire time I was there was like, I do not give a damn about this. I was sitting there and I like, this is how the level of apathy that I had in that situation was I got to this pre-sequester house, and the handler is there, takes my phone and personal effects, and he's like, "Do you have any questions?" And I was like, "So, am I an alternate or am I actually going in?" I'll explain this in a little bit. And he's like, "Oh yeah, you're actually on the show." And I was like, "Oh, okay, all right, fine." And then I was
bummer.
Like, I was like, "All right, has anyone ever escaped this? Has anyone ever just bugged out and left?" And he was like, "I don't really like this line of questioning." And I was like, what can I do? But I basically was sitting there. I'd watch Simpsons, and I would think like, I was almost like, what am I even doing? Like, this seems like I'm starting to have regret already about this. And then going into the day we moved in, we basically were in the same type of holding rooms that we were placed in one at a time going into Big Brother 14. I'm sitting there watching episodes of The Simpsons on a portable DVD player. And I said to the handler, I was like, I told him throughout the 2 weeks, I was like, I want to listen to music while I'm laying in this pool and getting a tan. And he would play whatever on Spotify. And I said, but I have one song request, like the last 5 minutes before we walked to the house. And I remember I wouldn't say what it was. And then as soon as we get to that point, I'm like, I want to hear Extreme Ways by Moby right before I get into this. And I didn't feel nervous at all. Sitting in that room, I was watching, New Kids from the Black was the last episode of The Simpsons I watched where they form a boy band. I was watching that episode like it was any other day, sitting there eating a candy bar like it did not matter. The instant, however, where we are walking up to the house and we are in our initial group of four and I am seeing the folks that are joining me, I could feel the shakiness, right, as folks in this group come up. The way we were initially lined up, I saw a gentleman of African American. I couldn't see exactly who it was because they were told to face forward. And then once I got closer, I got a good look. I was like, whoa, Kevin Campbell, that is just that is a really, really exciting pick. And I immediately thought, wow, Colin Stone is going to be pretty excited about this. and Tyler was there as well, who I immediately recognized. And he was someone who I just automatically assumed was just a mortal lock. There was just no chance that there was going to be an all-star season with that guy not present. So when I saw him, that was pretty much assumed. And then I was like, all right. And we were told it was going to be a group of four because they did give us the rules for room race, that intro competition prior to going in and how that would work. So we knew what to do. And we were told it was a group of four. So I'm like, all right, and who is going to be number four in this group? Is this where Josh comes around the bend? Is this where Derek is there? Is it going to be Dan? And then Enzo comes with a backward hat that says meow, meow. And I am like, that was not exactly the direction I thought that this was going to go.
Yeah.
But I looked at this group and I was definitely at that point, I started to get nervous. That was where like the butterflies were in my stomach and I was definitely feeling it because the way that this whole group like entering in waves process, like coming down there, like you're going to be put in a holding room. When you're told it's time to go, you're going to walk down the stairs to the living room. Do not look over the balcony. We want you to come down the stairs and see who you're playing with. As this is being described to me, and they're like, it may be people that you know or have history with. As this is happening, I'm fully expecting, yeah, Dan and I aren't in the same group, obviously. We're going to walk down the stairs. We're going to see each other. And it's going to be like, all right, fancy playing with you. it's going to be interesting. So for me, I was fully expecting that. And it's like, all right, here we go. Like, let's play. Let's see what I can do. And the way that, obviously the way it's set up as far as that first HOH competition goes, obviously I do not know the other 12 people that are going to be joining me. So I think that it is, as soon as the way that that this competition was going to work was explained, I said, there is absolutely no scenario in which I do not want to be a player that does not sink their ball into that maze game. There is no scenario in which I want to be in a spot where I have 0% chance of winning head of household, and I do not know the other cast. I know the value of the first HOH, so I'm going to gun as hard as possible for that spot in HOH Part 2.
Okay, I wasn't sure when I made that genius prediction earlier about potentially you not giving this one full effort. I don't remember the order, but I thought it may have been that you could like see that Cody or someone you were okay with potentially had already put up a good time, and it wasn't necessarily worth it potentially to let the cat out of the bag right away or refresh people's memories that you could be quite a force in competitions. When Cody ultimately does win this, where did he stack up for you in terms of people you were hoping to see win?
I mean, out of that group of six, I would put him at probably fourth preference. I would say, obviously, Memphis is dead last by a mile. I remember when they said people that got their ball in behind the wall, everyone else sitting on those stools over there, I was just thinking to myself, Memphis, please do not join me on the other side of this wall. And when he does, I'm like, oh, damn, this is looking like a sweat. So I'd say Memphis is fourth preference. Christmas, I have no idea anything about her. All I know is that she broke her foot the first time she played. I know literally nothing else about Christmas. And then I felt like Kevin and Nicole A, I felt like if they won, those were going to be people that would not necessarily I would naturally gravitate to, but I felt like they would naturally gravitate to me and that I would probably have very little to worry about. That being said, my first initial thought, even when the rules of this game are being explained to me in that holding cell, is if you are one of those eight people that does get to play in HOH Part 2, if there is, I mean, my brain thinks old school Big Brother. The first thing that comes to mind is the surfboard accord in Big Brother 6, where the people that are on that winning surfboard and they know one of them is going to be the first HOH, my brain immediately says there is no reason that a deal should not be struck among those eight people. Someone will say something. Hopefully it does not have to be you. But I figured there has to be someone who is smart enough to realize one of us eight is going to be the head of household. We should not be nominating each other. Pick from the other group. They didn't get their ball in. Point blank, end of the story.
I actually, I tweeted out in real time as that competition was airing, I think there might be a six-way deal getting made behind that wall right now, but it seems like no.
No. I mean, no one would say a damn thing. I don't know if this was because pre-game things had been decided. I think there may have been, at least my hesitation is, if there was pre-gaming, do I want to be the one to say this and then it gets carried to whatever the pre-game, you know, whatever pre-game alliance it is. I felt like once Kevin and Nicole and I were the only ones back there, I pretty much looked at them. I said, look, if I win it, anyone that was behind this wall is safe. And I think that that's a narrative that should be pushed regardless. Cody had a pretty good time. And going into my shot where I knew that it was either going to be me or Cody being the first HOH, I pretty much had the understanding going in, I do still want this. This is primarily going to be a game of chance that I just don't hit one of the wobbly stars, and I just pretty much have to make it. If I miss even once, I am not going to be the first HOH. So I gave it a good effort on that first run, but as soon as I fall, it is not even a doubt in my mind, you are going to hit a wobbly star on that way back to make sure that people see that you did not know which way to go on your second attempt. Because there is no chance I'm winning that once I mess up once. So you may as well throw something out there to make it look like you don't know what's going on.
So Cody is our first head of household here. You are still probably trying to get your head around everything that's going on and who you're actually going to be playing with. Right away, it seems like, maybe not on literally night one, but early on, you certainly develop quite a bond with Nicole F that we will get into shortly. But besides her, who stood out of the people as you were scanning the room on that first evening as, okay, under the right circumstances, we could potentially really make something happen here?
Kacer. There was a little bit of hesitation, obviously, because it's plain as day. His number one is going to be Janelle. And that obviously with, you know, my idea going in, that's going to be a little bit tricky. But Kacer was someone who I wanted to work with, and just in initial conversations that we were having, you know, he was like, well, what was your last experience like? And it's like, well, it was pretty good because I won. He's like, well, winning is a gradient. And then he just goes on about this like philosophical idea. I'm like, I like this guy. This guy is someone I can connect with on an intellectual level. And as I said in the DR, and they had no idea what I was talking about, when I'm talking to Kacer, I do not feel like I'm playing Big Brother. I feel like I'm playing the genius. And that's just something that I really appreciated with him being there.
Totally. And I definitely wanted to get into the idea of Kacer and Janelle so clearly being each other's number ones. Even the people on the show who have very rough memories of the early seasons, if they know anything about the Arnold Shapiro era of Big Brother, they probably know about Kacer and Janelle. And not only that they are so tight, but Kacer and Janelle, for one reason or another, it seems like often find themselves in situations where it's, okay, here's our side and here's everyone else. Did you get the sense that that was developing early this time around as well? And did that concern you about potentially being viewed as too close with them?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, there's no question about it. On day two, and we'll get into this with Safety Suite, when those two are the only ones to swipe, it is, in my mind, very clear. They are positioning themselves to be in that spot of it is a healthy amount of people versus them. And any perceived closeness to them is going to be a problem. And I will get into this. But, yeah, I felt like that was going to be something that was in play here.
All right. And then also, again, it seemed like Nicole F. Was someone that you gravitated to pretty quickly. And throughout your whole time in the house, it really seemed like she wanted to keep you around for longer. How did that develop, and how important do you feel like that relationship with her was in keeping you looped in with what was going on?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was pretty much immediately obvious to me. I mean, just before even going into the season, you know, one of the quantifiable things that just never seems to come up when we're discussing, like, picking who you want to sit next to in the final two or making decisions on survival to the final two versus getting to the final two and actually winning is that picking the right person to sit next to, you know, against anything else, against pure survival, pays 10 to 1. That is absurd, right? You have the point of indifference between survival and being in a final two where you win is 10%. I mean, that to me is just plain as day. You need to pick someone to work with that you have a chance to beat in the end. And if you are sacrificing survival chance to work with that person, that is fine because it has to be so much to outweigh that number. I don't know what the perception is going to be with letting someone win again. I think that as far as the early goings go, this is you must work with this person. It is not a choice in either direction. This is a symbiotic relationship that your win condition is directly tied to mine as far as I'm concerned at this point. This is the lion and the mouse. This is the alligator and the crocodile bird. It is not an option.
I was about to say the exact same thing. Yeah.
There was some discussion back all the way in BB14 of Dan maybe either feeling or should have been feeling like the only way he was ever going to get that money was sitting next to either a former winner or someone who was so strongly disrespected that would be the only thing that could bring that into play again. Yeah. Did you feel like you were maybe in that same position of, well, if I'm not next to Nicole, then either someone's going to have to make themselves really, really unpopular or I'm always going to be fighting an uphill struggle here?
Correct. That was my idea going in, and I'm willing to play that game. I'm willing to play that dangerous game, right? Of saying, look, this is who I need to sit next to. You know, I think that we, you know, I think this is something that does get overlooked a lot in Big Brother 14. In that, first off, no one is saying you, Dan, needs to play to sit next to Mike under any circumstance. I do not think that is true. I think that Dan needs to get Mike and Janelle and Brittany on that jury, or at least at least have two coaches on jury that could have some sway with some of the newer players in order to win that game. But there's three boots before jury starts once they're all dumped in. That is not that hard of an ask, especially when you have effectively HOH control in two of those rounds. One of them is effectively your HOH. So as far as I'm concerned,
Janelle was the worst possible boot there for the Danielle HOH.
There is no question about it. I mean, that is where the game is lost. Obviously, if he sits next to Mike, that is a slam dunk win for him. Mike is Mike did not do anything to even attempt to think about playing the main Big Brother game. He treated new players that were not on his team basically as non-entities to him. And he as soon as he's dumped in, he just does not even want to be there anymore. It could not be any more obvious, right? So, you know, I think that really what it comes down to is, obviously if you can get next to the other winner, that's probably going to be my best chance. And I'm willing to play that game because, again, it's 10. I'm getting paid 10 to 1 on this versus survival. And if the only thing I even care about is winning, then this is just very clear. It's a have to. There is no option here. Like I said, it is the mouse and the lion. My win condition is sort of tied in a way to yours. And this is a must. This is a must. On top of that, as far as table draw goes, because that is something that I'm looking at here in the early goings, there was not a doubt in my mind that the person that had the absolute best table draw out of the 16 players in there was Nicole F. There is just absolutely no question about it. She is playing with friends. She is set up very well. She's going to have a lot of influence socially. This is someone that you should be working with. And like I said, it is the lion and the mouse. You have to work with me. It's not, yeah, she has options. She has more options than I do. But if you're thinking the way I'm thinking, you have to work with me. And it's not even a choice.
Yeah. You do love those forced lines, as they are called in chess. Yes, forcing lines.
I think about Jim Rice in that spot on Survivor South Pacific, where it's like you want to put yourself in a spot where you are working with people who need you. This is just plain as day opportunity.
Absolutely. You make yourself indispensable, you will find yourself indisposed. So who else besides Memphis was standing out as someone that I think most people playing pretty much any kind of reality season are often going to encounter along the way, which is a person in the game where it seems like this is just a complete non-starter. I'm just going to try to limit the damage incurred along the way here. Was anyone else on that same kind of tier as Memphis?
No, not even close. Not even close.
And furthermore, despite, I think very reasonably anticipating a lot of recency bias in the cast, when you show up and you see, oh my god, that's Kevin Campbell, that's the Meow Meow, Enzo, there's Keisha, there's, as much as I don't want to see it, there's Memphis, these are all people who have played before I did. What did you think about just the general cast itself from, like, a fan perspective?
I will say I was a little surprised by the fact that some of the bigger names did not show up, but at the same time, it did, to me, at least have this very another analogy to the genius. It had that grand final feel where it was pointed out when we were in our group of four, this group contains first placer, two second placers, and a third placer, or sorry, one second placer and two third placers. It seemed like the way that they went with this was pretty similar to that Genius Grand Final cast, where we are picking people that finished in the top three, and then a handful of wild cards that are just people that are interesting that we'd like to see play again.
Yeah, absolutely. So we are now underway. We're here. Cody is head of household. And day two, I guess. I didn't realize it was that early into the game, but it does make sense now with the way that they accelerate everything and have for a long time, and I'm just totally old school. We have our HOH right away, and we then get introduced, it turns out, on day two to the safety suite. Talk us through finding out about this from your perspective.
Yeah, so obviously it was teased to us on day one during the live show. We had no idea how this twist exactly would work other than what it was called. And it implies that at least one person, possibly more, would be safe. From what I had read about Big Brother 20, literally half the cast plus the HOH was immune in week one. So that means that there are seven people to choose from in that scenario for nominations or eviction. And that is just, to me, where my mind goes when that safety suite is announced. I'm thinking that, like, possibly eight people, maybe seven people are going to be immune, and that Cody is going to be picking from half the set. Day two rolls around, and the safety suite logo pops up on screen, and Cody is called to the DR. We're called to the living room. And, this is the moment for me when it starts to get real. So Cody comes out of the DR and he reads the rules off. And I really liked the producer that's in charge of Twist reading the off-camera rules to this. So effectively, everyone is given this VIP ID pass that they will use to swipe in to a room to play an optional competition. This pass can be used once during the first 3 weeks. Whoever wins is locked safe for the week and gets to pick a plus one. The plus one gets a punishment, but who really cares about that? And, this is actually, as far as I'm concerned and it's being explained to me, I am thinking this is probably the best twist in the early rounds that I think that Big Brother has ever come up with. It has everything that makes a good twist. I'll go into this. It's perfect information, so it's going to be taken into account in strategic planning, which I think is really important. I know I talked with Eric Stein about this, the prevalence of mystery powers and how, it's just like you don't know what you're up against, so planning on a strategic level is going to be, to an extent, sort of neutralized by those secret powers. So it's perfect information. So it's going to be taken into strategic planning openly, which I think is great. It has a competitive aspect to it, which is great. And it also has this really nice social aspect to it of getting to be the plus one, who you select, how do you come to that decision? I think that's great. And then there's even this, when do I use it? When do I not use it? Aspect to the game. Or do you want to use it when it's, an HOH where it's a big sweat? Do you want to try to play in a week where not that many people are playing to increase your odds of winning the safety suite competition? I thought that it was just, from a game theory perspective, incredibly well designed. I thought that it was pretty much just the stone cold nuts as far as Big Brother Twist goes. And I honestly would not mind this being a staple in all future Big Brother seasons. I think it is just that well designed.
Yeah, there was somewhere along the way that in some Survivor podcast we did, I floated the idea of how good it would be during the early post-merge, and I don't know where the cutoff should be, but for the individual immunity winner to also then have to give one necklace to someone else. And I say have to, I think it would be viewed as like a privilege at first, but I also think it would function the same way that picking someone to go on a reward used to function, right. In as far as forcing the person to declare who their clear number one is. And I think Survivor really needs that, probably even more so than Big Brother does. But Safety Suite seem to serve a similar purpose here. And I'm sure, Ian, you had the same thought that I and many others did, which is this is virtually identical to the Token of Life from the genius that made 100%. That game so perfect.
100%. I mean, as again, and going back to the off-camera rules, I mean, my first thought is it is the Token of Life. This is so dope. Like, was the producer watching the genius when they came up with this idea? It is just so good. And I love to see that similarity there. Additionally, when they were explaining the off-camera rules, one of the things that was stated is players may not hide, destroy, or in any way prevent other players physically from using their VIP pass, right? And so then my brain immediately thinks, okay, so the Doohy special is not in play here, because I certainly thought about it. I mean, I was like, is that in the spirit of this game where I could just take people's VIP passes and just throw them out? That was something, I mean, it certainly crossed my mind.
I don't know if that was in the spirit of the Monopoly game even, but it's definitely worth a thought.
It certainly was something that I thought of is, so if you need the VIP pass to swipe in, if someone loses their VIP pass or it gets misplaced, they can't swipe in. And then it comes up, it's like, well, you can't do this. And it's like, okay, fair enough. I'm glad that they put that in the rules, because it does make sense as far as the spirit of the game goes. But it's something that I considered, and the Doohey line was immediately obvious. And then when they explained the way that the timer process would work, in that you would have 1 hour, they just said some amount of time. I believe it ended up being 1 hour every single time. Maybe the last time it wasn't, can't quite remember. But this idea of 1 hour to make that decision, I'm immediately thinking today's menu. If you are making any sort of action, your eyes are on that clock as it's ticking down without any question about it. And you are making your decision with as little time left on the clock as possible. It just makes sense. If you swipe when there's 1 second left, and you're the only person playing, you're virtually guaranteed immunity. There is a way in which it could not happen. If all players time out, no one gets the safety or plus one that week. Very unlikely.
I had a question about that. As far as Janelle and Kacer in week one, is it seems insane for if they're the only two to swipe. What are the how high do the odds of someone timing out have to be for them to not save one of theirs and just let one win by default and save the other one and still be able to play the following week? Did they just swipe super early and expect others to also swipe?
I do not know when they swiped. I believe they swiped relatively late.
I think they swiped at the last second, actually, now that I'm thinking of it. So
as they should.
For sure, but why both swipe?
I do think it was that possibility of timeout.
Okay, and can you quickly clarify how that works?
So essentially on timed competitions in modern Big Brother, there is a specific time at which they're just like, all right, they don't want the feeds to be down that long, I suppose. So they just say, all right, you're not winning this. It is over. You do not get to continue. It is just an automatic forfeit, essentially. So in that first game, the timeout was 25 minutes. Kacer finished it in, I think it was like 7 minutes or something like that. And Janelle was roughly double that. Like, I think it was like 13 some. So it seems like they weren't really close to timing out. I imagine it would be pretty difficult to time out, though. We did see it in that that bizarre baseball sequencing game that came up in the final six, where multiple players timed out. Apparently, they just didn't understand the objective from what was discussed in the jury house. It is possible to time out. I know for Getting Tipsy, the one that I played in, the timeout was at 12 minutes.
Okay.
And for Stealing Safety, I believe it was 25 as well.
Okay. Thank you. So they end up both becoming safe here. How are you feeling just during these early days about your position and just the dynamic overall?
I mean, I'm a bit jaded from last time, right? So I definitely felt like that those two were a pretty likely nomination set. My understanding was that Cody had kind of ruffled, Kacer and Cody had kind of gotten into it a little bit, not super into it, but there is a bad vibe apparently, something of that nature. And Kacer felt like he was going to be nominated, which from what I've read is pretty accurate. So that definitely takes two targets off the table that presumably are ahead of me in line. I am thinking at this point, I am heavily relying on Nicole to ensure that I am safe for this round. And I feel like that's a pretty solid line to take. You know, I know for me, just as a previous winner, there is going to be the temptation that, you know, that I should just be nominated just right from the get-go based on that alone. So definitely it's a sweat. I don't feel like I'm in like immediate danger of being in that initial nomination set, but I definitely have some fear, some concern that I could be a replacement nominee if things came to it.
And as far as just general approach in literal week one of a modern Big Brother All-Star season, what were you, how far were you willing to go, I guess, in terms of like firm commitments being made to people? Or were you just trying to stay out of the limelight and don't get put up?
Stay out of the limelight for the most part. I would speak in kind of, my whole thing, I want to keep flexible. I want to stay flexible for sure. But I talked to Cody and I said like, I definitely have interest in working with you. I will go ahead and just say the people that I had met outside of this game on at least one occasion, all to varying degrees on this season, are Cody, Danny, Davon, Enzo, Janelle, obviously. Apparently, I had done a podcast with Kacer on RHAP, which I did not remember. So there was that. I had met Kevin exactly once. I had met Memphis exactly once. And obviously, Nicole F. So those are the people that I knew. With Cody, my experience with him was that me, him, Derek Lavisser, and here's a random name, Jace Agoli from Big Brother 17, at some sort of reality charity event, we went to Panera Bread and ate lunch together during this Orlando event. I also distinctly remember that as I was driving us from Panera back to the hotel, the song Lean On by Major Lazer was playing, and Cody really liked that song. I remember him saying that. So I was like, we had that lunch at Panera Bread, many years ago. And the line I was trying to take with him is, I felt like we were in a spot where, and obviously it is quite a bit different, but like, we're taking the person that we made a commitment to take to the final two. And I really respected that you did that. And I think that it speaks to the caliber of loyalty that you bring to this game. And, I'm trying to lead him into, you would do that as well. So, you're someone who is, good to work with. Now I will say, I think one of the things that always bugged me about 14 was that, as far as week one goes, your only goal is just to not try to be someone who's forming anything counter to the HOH prior to nominations, and you might be all right. In 14, the unfortunate thing was those lines were drawn prior to arrival, right? It was always going to be Janelle and Brittany's players are working together. Dan and Mike's players are going to be working together for that first round. And in 14, I did not like that I was immediately on the outs, regardless of anything social that I did in the house. I was always in that mix of five people that those nominations were realistically going to be drawn from. I was not too keen on that. Going into this, I was like, oh boy, a clean slate. Wrong. obviously, there was pre-gaming. out, you know, to such an extent that that was not even the case. That being said, one thing that I was immediately just like very put off by was on day two, Kevin and Nicole A. Are sort of approaching me to form this alliance on the day bed upstairs in that balcony across from the HOH room. And it very much seemed like a sort of counter alliance to the current HOH. And my spidey senses are going off, and I'm just like, bad idea, bad idea, bad idea. This is not what I do not want to be in an alliance counter the HOH prior to nominations. I don't want to be associated with this. Absolutely not. No, 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 no. You know, that is just not what I want to be a part of. So I was definitely trying to distance myself from them. I think one of the things that just didn't really get mentioned a whole lot from what I've been reading is that there is a very distinct disadvantage that the have-nots are placed in that first week, where our bedroom is completely isolated from the rest of the house as far as sleeping arrangements go. That room is primarily going to be slept in only. It is not a comfortable room to hang out in, obviously. So there is not going to be that late night discussion and having fun where, you know, you're just talking to people and meeting people on a social level, you know, where you're just laying in bed, you can't sleep, and you're all just chattering about whatever. So, you know, you are missing out on that by being up in that have-not room, which is, I mean, basically as far as you can get from the bedrooms, you know, the main bedrooms in that first week. So it really does, I think the effect of that is sort of understated as to what position it puts you socially in that first round.
Was it a different room in BB14?
Yeah, it definitely was. What was the key room this time was our have-not room. The have-not room for us was upstairs in what was the coach's suite or Pandora's box in Big Brother 14. It's just the door was moved to be, you know, to the balcony rather than the HOH room.
Did Pandora's box end up with a literal 100% opening rate?
Yes, it did.
That's incredible. And probably just a total coincidence. So we can move on from that. I wondered not only about week one, although I thought this would potentially be an extreme example of it. Is there a different feeling when you're having one of these less safe feeling weeks after the veto ceremony, when you know for sure you can't go up this week? Is there like, is that like a very distinct checkpoint in a given week in Big Brother?
Oh, hell yeah. Hell yeah. I mean, I think this is something that, you know, kind of got brought up a little bit in that apparently people noted that my behavior would shift as soon as that veto box was shut in any given week, that I would feel comfortable for at least a couple of days. I know that was one of the things that kind of came up in discussions, and what Danny mentioned to me in the jury house when, you know, obviously things came to light later in the season. But yeah, I mean, for me, the way I always think about it is, that time after the veto box closes, that for me is the, scurrying time where if there are bad roles for you that you can do something about, this is the time where you're gonna make those inroads to go ahead and correct that and minimize those sequences from occurring.
Sure. So Kevin and Keisha are on the block. Enzo wins this first power veto and chooses not to use it. And it seemed, based on my sketchy memory of it, and totally incomplete information, it seemed pretty straightforward, like Keisha was out the door without a ton of suspense. Was that the sense you got in the house?
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, I definitely got the vibe that she had a really bad case of Carol Journey syndrome. For me, I think where it was a little bit interesting, everyone was kind of keeping their cards close to their chest with me. you know, I think Kacer and Janelle were really pushing hard to flip things and get Kevin sent out the door. I don't know. I think maybe initially I was like, it's sort of unsure which way this is going. But then it kind of became pretty clear the direction that this vote was going to go. One thing I would like to flag up is in the that first veto competition, we'll say in that first week, one thing that I felt like was holding me back was the instructions for cooking the steel cut oats for slop were wrong. They said to boil the water or boil this mixture for 5 minutes. That was not nearly enough time. Basically all of the have nots, me and Nicole A especially, were getting incredibly sick. I mean, the day of the veto, I was vomiting. Just like in you know, so I definitely was something that was definitely affecting my ability to kind of assimilate to the group. And on top of that, you know, I felt like as far as the veto draw went, I felt like it was a good draw in general, for the idea of keeping the nominations the same. But one thing that I definitely kind of was feeling during that first veto comp, because I'm kind of like, you know, I wouldn't mind winning this. I mean, it's like lock save for the week. I'm not maybe as invested as I would be as if I, you know, I'm on the block, but it's just kind of like, hey, whatever. You may as well just put like some effort towards this. But one thing I immediately thought was, if I had known what a typical winning score for this game was, then, and I was, you know, like say I'm on the block and I'm just like, this is a must win. You know, like if I do not win, I'm 100% out the door. It's not a matter of keeping a nominee from winning it. It's just a, you know, it is either you win this or your equity is, you know, a hard zero. Then, I mean, the fact that I do not know that winning scores on this game are typically around 17, 18, 19, that is where I immediately, you know, realized, having talked to Nicole A after about what the winning score the year before was, I was like, this is where maybe not watching is going to cause me a problem.
Do you feel responsible about the have-not situation being so much worse and the slot being bad, the room being out of the way? Is this teaching you a lesson for making such a mockery of it the first time, I guess, is what I'm getting at?
I really didn't care that much. I think that, you know, my philosophy with any of this, any of these punishments is that no serious player would give a damn. And I felt like, and honestly, my attitude throughout was, I'm not going to complain. This is bad. It does suck. I am not going to complain about this. That is just not something that's going to happen. And, no complaining allowed. I'm throwing up and, I'm just going to try to ignore it. Definitely was worried that I was going to defecate during the veto competition. I definitely did not feel like I was, my stomach was too great. But yeah, I mean, I'm not going to complain.
Okay. And then, one other note here that I had on week one that I would have been wise to bring up when the genius had already come up organically, one of the highlights of the season for me, if not the literal highlight of the season for me, was night one, live feeds come on. Oh, yeah. I don't remember if it was Duck and Pumpkin first or Dolphin Crash first,
Dolphin
but
Crash
those two
first.
Shirts being on the live feeds in the early days were some of my fondest Big Brother memories that I will ever have.
Yeah, so, I mean, the Dolphin Crash idea I pretty much had, you know, I think you fly it up on the BB-8 stuff. You know, I really was just like, yeah, we're going to do this, for sure. And, that was a must do. And then Duck and Pumpkin, I felt like was just mandatory as well. There is just no doubt about that.
I did love with the Duck and Pumpkin shirt that my first exposure to it on the feeds back when I was still glued to those in the first week was, it wasn't seeing you in it. It was Danny leaving a room and saying, did that shirt say Duck in Pumpkin? And I was like, oh, Ian.
Oh, yeah.
And that's what I really wondered, like, what other sartorial, things were in store for us over the rest of the season.
Yeah, I did. I actually, I did have a a Where's Boogie shirt printed, and then things kind of, you know, there was some interesting
things
there.
Maybe it didn't age so well, yeah.
So I was like, you know, let's not bring that one in. But yeah, I mean, those were the three. You know, obviously the Where's Boogie one was a nice orange color. I felt like these were, I thought it was a pretty funny idea. And, you know, I think just other week one folly, if we want to talk genius references, I pretty much compared myself to the bastard child of Jun Seok and Kyung Hoon in the Big Brother game. And I feel like that there is just no analogy that could possibly be better for me as a player. This is, I mean, between those two especially, there is going to be a lot where it comes up. Where I find myself playing and feeling like those two as this game is going on.
Yeah, I love that. I also loved the suit vest nod was very strong, and the reference to 2012 Ian Terry entering the house in the same wardrobe you won in on finale night in BB14 was very strong.
So that actually is a funny thing. So it is similar. It's a light blue shirt. The lilac or lavender shirt, I wore that same lavender shirt that I won in on my eviction. That was the same.
Oh, exact, okay.
Same exact shirt.
They look very similar. I always think of that as the Ian Terry finale night look. Yeah. And I remember Aris wore the same thing on the Blood versus Water final tribal council. And it stood out to me as the Ian Terry.
Yeah, Max Dawson and I, we're very close, and I mean, the conversations that Max and I have about sense of dress is just light blue button-up shirt and khakis is pretty much the go-to. When I was teaching, I remember like the school I worked at had school uniforms. One of them, they had a few that they could choose from. One of them was this mustard yellow color that I thought was just like, by far the worst option of the three if you had to pick. I said, I would wear the navy blue one every day before I would put on the mustard yellow one. And there's just no question about it. And then some girl in class just says, like, at least we don't wear a light blue button-up shirt every single day. And I was, and then everyone laughed. I'm like, yeah, that's actually a pretty fair point.
Max Dawson, yeah, absolutely. You two could do an entire podcast about the value of the Oxford shirt. Yeah, what else?
And the reality of it is I don't feel like having to put forward thought about what I'm wearing that day. I have other things on my mind. So, you know, if I have five of the same light blue Oxford, then that's fine with me.
Okay. What else from week one, if anything comes to mind?
I definitely felt like there was a little bit of the sweat. Definitely didn't want Keisha or Kevin winning the veto because I did have a little bit of replacement non-fear. As far as week one goes, a conversation I had with a friend, this was a little bit kind of pivotal on like my refusal like to go ahead and even consider voting Kevin out, was I did not want to vote out any of the – I did not want to actively contribute to the elimination of any of the POCs in the first week or two of the game. I did want to see – those players get a fair shake, something that I had seen come up on Twitter a lot with Survivor and Big Brother. And it was just something that I kind of felt strongly about, sort of like an outside the game kind of thing. And I didn't think that it would have that much of an effect choosing between the two, although that may have been may have not turned out so well. But I didn't think it was that big of a deal in choosing between which one would stay and which one wouldn't. So I felt like that was reason enough for me.
Well, this is something I was going to ask about later, but now seems like a reasonable enough time. As these early weeks would go on, was there any kind of discussion about the optics of how this was going?
In my mind, that was just, there is no question about that. With 4 Prime, one of the things that I would lament to myself was I'm in this alliance, supposed alliance of 4 people, and there is not one person of color in this group. And that, to me, is something that I was not too happy about optically. We will get to the week 5 nomination set. My first thought when that occurs is, damn, I'm better at this game than I thought. And secondly, holy shit, I am embarrassed to be taking part in this. I would like to leave now.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Actually, a couple other things that I was curious about, like how they progressed. If you have kind of early day memories along these lines, one is the prospect of a battle back, which I didn't realize until perusing the BB22 Wikipedia this morning. This was the first season since your original season that didn't have a battle back. How front of mind was that for people?
I think that was something that was at least considered in a few cases. As far as the meta game goes, I think there were really two major meta considerations, one of which more than this battle back idea. It was something that was definitely considered. I think that for me, I ruled out a pre-jury battle back kind of right off the hot, just based on us being in this COVID-19 world. And just this idea that if you are going to be sequestering these folks, you're going to have to put them in contact with people that are not in the bubble. You're going to be taking them to a separate sequester house. And it's not like a jury where that sequester process is built in. So I felt like there was a much higher chance of there being a jury battle back than a pre-jury battle back, at least in my mind, just because you have to take those extra steps with a pre-jury battle back that jury has that process built in. That being said, I definitely got the vibe that since the season was only 85 days, it was not terribly likely that there would be a battle back.
When you were evicted, were you hoping to find out that there would be a battle back?
I was certainly hoping that there'd be a battle back. And when it was mentioned during the wall, like she says there's rumors that the five have been battling their way back in the game, and they are false. Everyone here has made it to jury, so congrats, I guess. The fact that it was explicitly mentioned, my brain immediately says, okay, so there may be a jury battle back at this point. That being said alone kind of made my brain think, well, I mean, the fact we're mentioning it, like, why are we putting that idea out there if it's not something that might happen? Mm-hmm. I kind of thought going in, no battle backs whatsoever based on the 85-day schedule. Obviously, though, our first eviction was on day 9, which is quite a bit earlier than usual. Like, we kind of lost a week, where usually first eviction is like day 13, 14. But, the way that I kind of thought about it was it doesn't seem likely. But when that was said, I thought there's a chance here. And certainly something in the ballpark, a possibility.
Okay, and then the other thing that I was wondering about, how frequently it was crossing your mind, and it seemed to be crossing, like, the house's collective minds.
Maybe this is the other meta thing.
What was this?
So I said there were two...
Oh, yeah, go for it.
Is this going to be that there is some sort of America's vote in play at some point?
It is not. Sorry, what did you say was the second one?
The second consideration of it, like, you know, as far as the game's evolution, battle back versus the idea that there was going to be an America's vote for some sort of power or something. Maybe instead of having a battle back, there's a re-entry vote from jury, you know, something of that nature. You know, America gets involved with Big Brother in the modern game. That's just something that I had read was happening frequently. And I think that especially in Janelle's case, there was a very active, it was a consideration. We need to get her out of here before America's vote comes into play, because we are assuming there is going to be one. And if she is around for it, that is a lock, a 100% lock that she gets whatever that advantage is. And we can just kind of, keep it open if that's something that happens.
Do you think would you say the dynamic around Janelle and Casey in the house was in any way informed by the fact that everyone knew, or at least had to know, that they were incredibly popular, they had this big fan base behind them, not just in terms of if there's a power that America gets to choose, then one of the two of them is surely going to get it, but also that was there an element of, like, jealousy of, or, you know, they've had their chance, or we want the spotlight to be on us, so we need to get it away from them, I don't think most people explicitly would say that, but did it feel like that was driving some of the push to keep them on the outs?
I actually do sort of feel like that was something that was at least considered. However, one thing I would say on this topic, I think there were kind of two anecdotes that I thought were funny. I remember when I was in jury house, Danny was like, I don't know why they invited people from pre-All-Stars 1 to be on this season. And then I was like, so Janelle and Kaser? And then she's like, well, I mean, yeah, that's just how it ended up being. But, like, they already had their All-Stars 1 chance. And then she's like, and besides, I mean, not so much Janelle because she was on 14. And I was like, so just Kaser then? Like, I was like, I don't really understand this. I was like, yeah, I agree. He doesn't fit on modern Big Brother. That is just not something that, you know, he just seems way out of place, as does Janelle.
It is a funny argument from someone who, you know, whose first season was immediately after the first All Stars and whose most recent time playing since then was before your first season. It's like, right. If anyone's a creature of past Big Brother, then you think Danny would be on that list too.
Right. I mean, I certainly would consider her older school. I mean, for sure. I mean, when I say old school, I'm thinking seasons 1 through 6, Shapiro era, or, you know, seasons 1 through 7, 2 through 7, really. But Shapiro era. Big Brother is, when I say old school, I think middle school is where Danny and I kind of fall into play, you know, those early Grodner Meehan years. That being said, yeah, the other anecdote that kind of comes to mind, as far as maybe jealousy or whatever goes, and I think this almost sort of refutes this idea that there was like an awareness maybe that they were, at least in some people's minds, I'm going to name names. But at least in some folks' minds that maybe this wouldn't be the case. But there was a discussion. It was the, you know, supposed four prime in that back room. This is when the argument occurs between Janelle and Nicole F over picking have-nots, which we'll get into, where Nicole, I said, like, oh, this is not good for your rating on Joker's updates there, Nicole. And she said, what do you mean? And I was like, you know full well that Janelle and Kaser are number one and two on that list. And the fact that you are going toe to toe with her makes you almost automatically number 16. And you could see just like this sick, visceral reaction that she was having to me saying that. And she was like, oh, I don't think so. There's no way the viewers at large could be supporting her and Kaser over me. And in my brain, I said, there is absolutely zero chance that they are not 1 and 2 on Joker's updates. And there is a very, very slim chance that you are not number 16 on Joker's updates. That I just didn't want to push the issue because I felt like she was made quite upset by that. But
with that in mind, did it shock you at all to see Devon eventually winning America's Favorite Player over?
Not at all. Not even a little bit surprised. In fact, when I was in jury house, I pretty much was like, I do not care about America's Favorite Player, really. That's just not something that makes any difference to me. So I basically said to Dave, when I was like, yeah, I actually hope you win it because I just don't care about it at all. And you seem like you would be a good person to represent the season winning that award.
I mean, more in terms of like, was it surprising that it was Devon who won it, and seemingly by a decent margin, instead of Janelle and Kaser, who, based on the kind of temperature of those of social media on the early weeks, like you could not say a word against Janelle and Kaser without being bombarded with messages about it.
I wasn't really that surprised. Sort of similar to 14, Janelle is out for the jury, and you know that obviously harms her chances of winning it to the point that Frank is able to go ahead and win that one. So I kind of felt like the fact that they were out pre-jury pretty much limited their chance to win. I there was no point during the time I was in the jury house, at least, that Devon was going to win AFP. Very little doubt.
I definitely agree with that, and am happy to see her win it. And I would imagine that the Janelle and Kaser popularity played whatever role it did, for a good reason. I think, you know, we just went and did a full rewatch of Big Brother 8 and did podcasts about all of that, which anyone interested can go find over on patreon.com/Dom and Colin. And one thing we talked about there with the advent of America's Player being introduced was this is totally correct on the part of everyone who is playing in every future season, and America's Player was the first kind of glaring example of it. And, you know, prior to that, yeah. Janelle in her early years was winning a phone call from Michael. And yeah, Yvette was all mad at her for getting it, but it wasn't having an impact on the game strategically in terms of giving her power. It was just making people mad at her. In the modern era, most seasons are now influenced by America getting to decide major things within the game. And we talked about, I think the line in the sand was just something that has come up already in this podcast, the coup d'etat that was gifted to Jeff in Big Brother 11. Yeah. Anyone who has seen that from that point forward would be massively foolish not to be factoring in America as a major player within the game.
Absolutely. And I think that this is something that sort of goes overlooked. That is your 17th player, if you will. That's definitely something that I'm cognizant of. And there was, I mean, you know, I'm definitely someone, you know, who is thinking about that. And, you know, like if one of the things, here's something that, like, one of the takes that I've seen, and there, I mean, there's just so much of it that it comes up, where I've read, like, oh, you know, this is what you get for not working with Janelle and Kacer. The reality of it is, the way that my brain is working, with Janelle and Kacer coming to me in these early goings and making, you know, offers to me, it seems very clear what direction they are heading in. I feel that I do not even need to accept that offer. I pretty much can just maintain flexibility and know for sure that if Kacer or Janelle wins HO, well, not Janelle, because we'll get into this because we're about to hit it, but if Kacer wins HOH, I know that I am safe for the week and I am getting that essentially for free. I can keep up appearances with the, you know, quote unquote, other side as I see it, which is, you know, four prime plus some variation of Christmas being worked in there and Tyler being in the mix with Cody somehow, and Enzo to an extent. So, you know, I can basically get that. I can bank on that for free. I don't even need to, you know, mark my flag. I am, you know, with Janelle and Kacer's face on it, it's like, this is my side. This is who I'm working with. Like, I don't need to do that. I'm getting that equity for free.
Yeah. It would be one thing if you had power of some kind and you use that in a way that helped the bigger alliance instead of Janelle and Kacer. At Correct. Least then you would see where that criticism is coming from. But right. I don't know what people want you to do more to help Janelle and Kacer that you did already. Like, if I guess you go to Nicole and you ask her to ask Cody to maybe consider keeping them around, and then you know, if that gets back to them, she doesn't want to do that, now your spot gets blown up. Like, I'm not sure what button you're meant to press differently, where suddenly that means Janelle and Kacer are safe and you all live happily ever after.
Yeah, I think the thing that needs to be considered here is that I would say, oh, the stars aren't aligning. I know that I said in one exit interview, it's like, you know, I can't magically just flip the entire house to ensure Kacer's safety. And you know, one of the bad takes that I saw was, you don't need magical power. Like, Dan's funeral was done because he had desire and he wanted to do it. Big, big difference. Huge difference. That is a horrible take. Those two situations are not even remotely similar. Dan was basically in a spot where it was 0% equity or a lot of equity. You have nothing to lose. In Kacer, in sticking up for Kacer and Janelle, I have equity to lose. And that is unfortunately, when competitions break certain ways, then I have to keep up appearances for my own sake to an extent. And, you know, obviously we will get to a point where I just get fed up with this, and my personal preferences as to which place I would most not like to come in comes into play. Where that isn't actively, you know, something that is actively taken into to decision making. But, you know, for me, yeah, I want to work with Kacer. That is the person that I want to work with. However, I am in that spot, as we had flagged up, where I have to work with Nicole, and I also know that Nicole is essentially my meal ticket to staying safe anytime that a Cody or, you know, as we will see in this week we're about to discuss, Memphis winning HOH, that is so critical to me having longevity in this game. And people will say, like, you put too many eggs in that basket. There was no other basket to put those eggs into, just based on how the competitions were breaking down.
And even with the Dan's funeral comparison, that only came into existence, and that only mattered because the nightmare scenario came true. Frank won the HOH, and now you have to somehow get Frank to change his mind, and then Jen won the POV, seemingly cementing his fate even further. Now you have to get Jen to change her mind.
And some clown pulled a veto ball out of a vending machine.
Right. Yeah. And so this whole sideshow only comes together because of a necessity created by the competitions. And I think it's easy for people, especially like us in a way, who try to analyze the game as if, you know, it's about the social element and the strategy element and the competitions are secondary. Ultimately, the competitions aren't secondary if the same alliance wins literally every single competition. At that point, there really is not much you can do about that.
Yeah, correct. And I think this is where I think Big Brother, like the analysis that is out there is just, I think this is what is being missed as far as, no pun there, missed, when we're talking about Dan. But I think what is just not being taken into account when you hear things about like onion theory or whatever is that in Big Brother, the competitions dictate the direction of the game considerably more than immunity challenges and obviously reward challenges in Survivor do. And it is a lot like backgammon where, you know, the analysis, you could say Survivor, you know, barring when is the merge, when is the tribe swap, right? It is much more linear in this idea of it is sort of more chess-like, right? Whereas Big Brother is more like backgammon, where the game can take any one of n squared, not quite n squared because the HOH itself, but you know, any one of many different directions, much like backgammon. You really are trying to just evaluate this game frame by frame. And it is not a, oh, I'm going to have this thing with the boot order locked in 7 weeks down the line because I can see this is how things are going to be. It is, I need to say, in N percent of scenarios, this is what will happen. I need to avoid the, you know, M percent of scenarios where it is bad for me. You're looking at it frame by frame. Big Brother, you are doing at most 2 or maybe 3 ply at any given time.
Yeah, I mean,
you're looking at it frame by frame.
We could genuinely do a very long podcast about the similarities between Big Brother and backgammon. It is remarkable the way that those two games end up just kind of working out over many iterations. But so we talked about the America's influence impact. We talked about the idea of a possible battle back, and that being something people were thinking about early on. The other thing that I wanted to ask about in terms of the progression in how kind of front of mind it was for you and in just kind of conversations within the house, hopefully people listening to this interview years from now are going to find this incredibly dated, but this whole season was, there was a question about whether or not it would even happen because of COVID. And I am imagining that being completely isolated from the rest of the outside world left you guys with a lot of questions about what was going on as far as all of that was concerned. Did you find yourself wondering less and less about that as the game went on, or was that something that was a regular part of your routine?
No, I would actually at points forget that outside of here, I would sit and say something like, oh, I can't wait to go to this bar. I really miss going to that. And now it's like, oh, wait, even when this is over, I still can't do that. Right.
Did so, you
like,
get any kind of updates about how
it went? Not if you ask Cody, but.
we did not really get updates as far as to the state of the world outside of the Big Brother house.
Yeah, that state of isolation is something that I think goes really under-discussed just in terms of what Big Brother can do to you psychologically, where we have had these really iconic examples before of people learning about events in the outside world. You think about Monica on BB2 learning that her cousin had died in the 9/11 attacks. I think there are cases where like people go in. Was it Big Brother Over the Top where they went into the house and learned about the election result in real time when they didn't know?
Yeah, that would line up. Yeah, that's OTT.
But this seemed like the first time that I can recall where everybody going in knew there was this global crisis unfolding, and you didn't know what it was going to be like in 2.5 months where you got out of there. Like, maybe it's going to look like some kind of zombie apocalypse movie where the situation's got 10 times worse. Maybe it's under control now. Maybe there's some news about a vaccine. It seems like it really could have gone any number of ways. Was that a kind of a constantly, was that an anxiety that was constantly weighing on you or maybe other people in there?
Yeah, I mean, it was something that I would briefly think about. I think for me, when I was kind of coming to this decision to do the show, one of the things I thought was, if I really don't like my work situation right now, maybe some time away from that would be good, and maybe, you know, this COVID thing is wrapping up, economy is better, you know, 2.5 months from now. You know, they're paying what they're paying for me to do it. And when push comes to shove, you know, maybe things will be better on the other side of this, just in terms of where the world is with COVID effects of that as far as, you know, on the economy and things of that nature. What I would also say, I think the joke, you know, that I made was, Andy Milonakis had a very popular tweet earlier this year where, you know, some astronauts launched off to outer space and he's like, they're leaving Earth, you know, and he's like, great choice. and I sort of felt like Big Brother was the same way.
Right? I like that a lot. Okay, so there goes Keisha. There goes week one, making great time here. No, this is...
Yeah, right. I mean, this may be a long one.
we may... at least verge on Tony Vlachos territory. I don't want to set the bar too high, but we may hit that kind of hour run, that many hours of runtime. We'll see.
Frankly, this may go longer than the breakdown of the season that Ian won.
We did. So that is going to be the end of part one here today, but plenty more coming, I promise you, very soon. So thank you to anyone who made it this far, and I promise, if you got all the way through that and are just dying for more Ian Terry content in the immediate future before, and just can't wait for parts 2 and 3, Ian has been on this podcast many, many times in the past, and you could probably fill close to 24 of these 48 or so hours with exclusively Ian Terry podcasts on this network in the meantime. So we will talk to you guys soon with the rest of this. And I guess it would be semi-pertinent, since this cut off kind of abruptly, to say, if you are unfamiliar with the podcast, if this is your first time finding us, I think there are going to be some of you. Dom is on Twitter at DomHRV. I am on Twitter at Colin Stone. And we do a lot of different kind of reality TV podcasting, noticeably more when Survivor is on air instead of on hiatus. But I guess we just actually passed 9 full years worth of back catalog here on this very feed. And then also bonus episodes, rewatching classic seasons over at patreon.com/Dom and Colin. So we will be back very soon with part 2. Talk soon, guys. Take care.